I like to begin this Bible study with a poem as an opening prayer. This poem is by a Brazilian archbishop, Dom Helder Câmara. Is anybody acquainted with him? He's done a lot of extensive writings on a variety of issues of spirituality and also on the situation in Latin America and interpreting that in many ways. So the title of this poem is Let Every Word. Let every word be the fruit of action and reflection. Reflection alone without action or tending towards it is mere theory, adding its weight when we are overloaded with it already, and it has led the young to despair. Action alone without reflection is being busy pointlessly. Honor the word eternal and speak to make a new world possible. Lord, make us instruments of your peace. Amen. This little book actually has a lot of things in it that I would really highly recommend. I know it's in the bookstore too, called The Desert is Fertile. The title always appealed to me anyway before I even opened it. It was a powerful image. What I'd like to do today, it says on the board up there that I have to come up with a title. I don't title my sermons, and I have a hard time titling my Bible studies too. Bread for the Journey. For a number of reasons, we're going to be reading Mark 6, verses 30 to 44. You may have noticed on Sundays recently the Gospels have been from John, the bread of the world. I am the bread of the world. And the lessons from Exodus of the manna being given. One of the things I decided I would like to try to do today is to give us a little sense of what the Bible looks like from other people's eyes. I am constantly amazed by, I mean it seems silly I should be amazed, being a pastor, but I'm amazed at the power of the Word. And I suppose that's part of the humbling thing for a pastor. I mean, it doesn't depend on the sermon or a lot of other things, but there's such power in the Word that sometimes, even though we often think we struggle more often to understand it, I think a lot of times we understand it too readily and feel a little uncomfortable with that. I think it's Mark Twain that said, it's not so much the passages that I don't understand that bother me, it's the ones I do understand that bother me. And along with that power of the Word, the power to heal, the power to enlighten, the power to give hope, also comes another power that seems to go together in a different kind of way, and that's the power to offend. So that sometimes accounts for that kind of a contradictory reaction of ours of really wanting to study the Bible, but at times kind of distancing ourselves from it. But I'd like to not distance ourselves today, but to look at it a little more closely. And the eyes I'd like to look at it with are some Latin American eyes. So, if you think we can do this, we will attempt to do this. I've asked this in other sessions. My name is Susan Berkelow, and I've been doing some sessions the last 2 weeks here on mostly issues around Central America. And I've asked almost every session I've been in how many people feel they have a real grasp of what is going on in Central America. Well, one, how about sort of a grasp of what's going on? Oh, there's a couple more. Okay. How many have no idea what's going on? Thank you, Harold. Well, we all know that there's war in Central America. We can start at that starting point. There is a lot of unrest in Central America right now. There's major war going on in which our country has been involved in very direct ways. I mean, it's in the paper regularly. We're sending arms to certain peoples, to the counter-revolutionaries who are fighting Nicaragua, to the military in Honduras and El Salvador. And so we know this, but we don't really understand, I don't think, very often why people are fighting. And of course we're told why people are fighting, why we're sending arms. I mean, they have to tell us why we're sending arms. Why do they say we're sending arms? The communists. Well, you got that one right off of us. Right, we're trying to protect this hemisphere from communism. I've been down to Central America several times, and many other people I know who have talked with people there, and we've said, why is there fighting here in Central America? And you'd be amazed at how many people say, well, it's because of our faith. It's because we've been living out our faith, and there are people who resist that and oppose that. And that's kind of a mind-boggling thing when you think about it. If you think of the people who are at highest risk of death in Central America, I think the first choice would probably be military or guerrillas, because obviously that's what they spend their time doing, is fighting, and they have a higher risk of death. But if you go beyond those that are directly involved constantly, who do you think has the highest mortality rate in Central America? Community organizers is probably number one, and that includes people who organize cooperatives, farming cooperatives, which is the basis of life there, people, health cooperatives too, people who organize health care have been, they were wiped out totally in Guatemala for several years, and just have recently again started doing that kind of health promotion and training of people. And who else would be up there?
What's the lifespan of a journalist?
It depends what part of war you're covering. There's journalists have had some casualties too. I think they're more visible when they happen. There's a very famous footage of a journalist who filmed while he was being shot, and so that gives it a big, a lot of visibility. But higher than journalists is, and you mentioned over here, catechists. And when you think that studying the Bible and teaching the Bible places you at a mortal risk, you have to wonder about how you read the Bible and say, what is there about this that really would cause such a reaction? And that's sort of what I would like us to look at today. What is it that we could, how can we look at the Bible to give a sense of what the offense is for people that is so great that they would kill because of it? I know a couple times I thought, just sitting here doing Bible study, sitting here together, this larger group of people in one room, that's not even possible in many countries without a great deal of suspicion. Or I remember even in Chile, having meetings were banned. You couldn't have a meeting. And so when the youth group met, I mean, that was a semi-seditious act, just getting the youth together. And I remember one of our youth group meetings, a soldier walking in and just standing there and looking around. And everybody sort of tried to pretend nothing was happening and invited him to sit down. And eventually he left. But, you know, that sense that, you know, whether people are together, something is happening. And it's something that's dangerous for those who are in control.
Can I throw in a term?
Sure.
I learned in Guatemala, the bourgeois servants.
The bourgeois servants?
Right. They're the ones who keep the oppression going. There are the military and the police for physical control,
mm-hmm.
the journalists and the clergy for thought control, and the academicians for technical support. The top group never have to encounter the masses. He has these servants, and they can either be for, you know, keeping the usual group in control, or leading the masses for revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But that, to me, that's a term that says a lot.
And that moves me right ahead to what I was going to say.
That's okay.
That's why, thank you for doing that. No, because I would like some verification of what I'm saying. This isn't just my idea here.
Especially with academic people. We're not a part of that. We're just doing good, truth stuff, you know.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Right, we're just the impartial observers.
Yeah, we're impartial.
Yeah. This could be a volcano. There are a lot of volcanoes in Central America. Actually, this represents the populace in Latin America. This is not scientific, but fairly true. The top part of the populace, you have like 2% of people who are very wealthy. In some, it varies from country to country, but like in El Salvador, 14 families ruled this country for I don't know how many years. And that power base still continues, even though they're still around. But very few people were really reaping the benefit of all the rest of the people resources and mineral resources and other resources of the country. And then there's a very small middle class of some professionals. It's developed over the last few years as society has developed. But for the largest part of the people down here are, for the most part, close to the agricultural society, the economy. They're poor people. They're campesinos. They're farm workers. And when they talk in Latin America about the people, this is what they're talking about. I know a lot of times for us just to be able to hear things, we have to at least put ourselves in another framework. When we say the people here in this country, we think of a large middle class, we think of sort of the whole country. But in Latin America, you're thinking in these terms, you're thinking of a small group of power and a large group of disenfranchised people who are, for the most part, very poor. And what you were mentioning is the power, the people that serve those who are in control here. Have included the military that have been very brutal. It's included the court system, government, which has been very corrupt. You can buy them out. And it's included the church, much as we hate to admit it over the last few centuries, that has served the elite. And so that's kept this going here. And these people have worked and sort of fed an economy that benefited a privileged few. a major thing happened in this century that changed that a little bit, and that is the Second Vatican Council. All of a sudden the church, some people in the church said, hey, wait a minute, we're in the wrong place here. We're not supposed to be serving an elite. We're supposed to be down here with the people, working with the people. And up to this point, the church had often, the priests had gone into these poor communities in the mountains, in the countryside, once a year, twice a year, and they baptized and confirmed and married and did everything that one Sunday and left again. But then after the Second Vatican Council, priests started moving into the communities and living with the people, and they gathered them around like this for Bible study. And instead of giving them just a sermon saying, this is what the Bible says for you to do, started asking, now what do you think this passage means? And what do you think this means? And asking the men and asking the women. And they started giving their answers. And as they began to be involved in the word in that way, things started to happen. They realized, gee, we don't have water. And that somehow doesn't correspond to my image of myself as the person God created. I wasn't created just to be a slave to somebody else. I was created maybe for something else. So what happened is the people gained a new sense of consciousness, and they were empowered by the word. And you can imagine, you just sort of imagine, this is, I like the image of the volcano in the mountain. You know, when people around here start moving around and getting informed and concerned and thinking they deserve something more than they have down here, than being the pyramid that serves the top, you can imagine how these people feel. Because that's a total threat to the structure as they know it and to the benefits they received. And so out of this kind of situation, a lot of assassinations occurred. In Guatemala for decades now, there's been this kind of repression where leaders were killed off, health workers, catechists, anybody that started to organize the people and give them a sense of their self-worth. And so as they started being attacked and wiped out and assassinated, people also responded in a variety of ways, and some of them was with an armed struggle as well. And so out of this ferment, a lot of the seeds of the current conflict came. But that's why today when you go and ask people, why are you fighting? They're not going to say, oh, because the communists came and told us we should fight against the U.S. They're going to say, because we have a history of struggle, of oppression. And as we've become aware of this oppression, we've decided to live our lives differently. And there are people who resist that, people who've always benefited. They have a very clear vision of this in their mind. But I think a lot of times we don't, and that's why it's hard for us to read the Bible with their eyes. Because it's the kind of reading they've done that's really set this thing loose. And so that's why I think it's important just to have a vision of that as we go ahead. Also, in the last few years, there have been many people martyred, notably, obviously. In 77 in El Salvador, a priest, Rutilio Grande, was killed. And that was sort of the first major incident of that in the church. And obviously, in 1980, remember, Archbishop Romero was killed. I mean, one thing is to pick off the priests in the countryside, and when you go for the archbishop, that's been a rallying call for the people that has never died. I mean, that is a powerful, powerful image of the fact that the struggle doesn't die. The people can die, but the word goes on, and God continually empowers new people to rise up, even as others are killed. The four women religious who were killed in El Salvador. And there's a long, long list. Whenever you go to some of these commemorations in Latin America, they have long lists of the martyrs, of people who've died because of their faith. And I don't think we're aware of that as much here, that you know, we're not talking just a political struggle here, although politics is definitely a part of it, but it's a struggle that's fed by people's faith in a very profound level. So how is it we can look at the Bible now, read this text as if we were somebody sitting here in Latin America? It's, in a sense, it's hard to do, but one way I want to offer to you today is a Bible study method that I learned when I was in Nicaragua from a priest who was working within a Salvadoran community. And at the time we visited them a couple of years ago, they were studying the Book of Mark, and they were using this one particular method, and every week they would go through another section of the Gospel. And I was really fascinated by this and have used it since then, too, and found to give sort of a fresh insight, and maybe will help us to understand what's going on there. I'm going to tell you what the method is, and then we'll read the text so you can be thinking about it as we're reading, and then we'll divide up in groups for you to talk about a little bit. Basically, the method consists of six questions, two groups of three. The first question is, what did Jesus do? I don't know how many of you have Bibles that have red letters of what Jesus said. So just imagine your Bible has red letters of what Jesus did, just for today. We're looking at his actions. And I know it's hard for us because we know so much of the words are in us. But just for today, focus on what Jesus did in this particular passage. Secondly, who resisted or opposed him and why? And thirdly, who benefited from what he did? So that's, what did Jesus do? Who resisted and opposed and why? And who benefited? And then the third set of questions are the same ones but applied to us. And were we to do what Jesus did? Were we to follow Jesus' example in this text? What would we do? What do we do? What would we do? And secondly, who resists or opposes us in that? Who will be our resistance or opposition? And thirdly, who benefits? Who will benefit from that? So that's sort of the framework. I want to engage us in some of our own context in this. So why don't we look at Mark 6, verses 30 to 44, and if we could read this together, and not too fast, but listening and reflecting as we read this, we'll see what we... Oops, I'm in my wrong Bible. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a lonely place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a lonely place by themselves. And when they saw them going, and knew them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns, and got there ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw a great throng, and had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is the lonely place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the country and villages around God, and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to the dead to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then he commanded them all to sit down by companies upon the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties. And taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the two fish among them all. And they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Sometimes you have to leave the language the way it is, because if there were 5,000 men, I think we can calculate there were a number of other women and children also involved. Later on, they do talk about another feeding in which they talk about the number of people, so I'm not sure how they did there. Well, obviously, it was easy for them to calculate when they were sitting in groups like that. What I'd like us to do right now is just to divide into maybe three groups, so they're small enough so we can talk, and just reflect on these questions. Can you remember them, or do you need them written up? I think you remember them. You might want to have somebody be a person to report out in another 10 minutes or so what your answers are to these questions, and we'll collect them all and put them on the board and see what we've found. This sounds pretty simple, doesn't it, right? Straightforward. Good.
Second part, if you were Jesus, what would you have done?
No. If you were to do what Jesus did then, today.
Today.
What would we do today to imitate what Jesus' action was in that time? One thing it's hard to do when you haven't done this before, too, is you might want somebody in the group just to help the group focus on actions, because we don't want Jesus' words or feelings or those things, but just to help steer the group in that one direction. Well, let's see what we came up with. See if we had any surprises. What did Jesus do? Why don't we, there's somebody from each group. Why don't we start with, we'll start with the last group to break up. Say, what did Jesus do? What did you have down? We'll just do the, what did Jesus do first, and then we'll go back. o'clock. Okay? He led. He commanded. Formed a miracle. Want to add?
I dealt with the problem. Had compassion.
What does that mean? I think having compassion is more of a feeling description rather than action. I think the actions show that he had compassion. Even if nobody said he had compassion, we might be able to deduce he had it by what he did. So let's.
Okay, I went away in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Went to shore. Divided the fish. Organized the feeding. Blessed and broke loaves.
About the other group, anything that you have that was left out here?
I think he, Jesus, may have known what he was going to do, but he purposely did not reveal everything all at once. He dumped it right on the disciples' shores. You give them something to eat. I think there's a sense in which he modeled some leadership for them and said, "You got to figure out what to do."
Okay, modeled. Modeled leadership in.
He wasn't just an authoritarian that told them what to do.
He
forced them to take charge a little bit.
Okay, it was a he gave them a collective task. So a collective style of figure it out. Okay. Anything else that's not up here that we don't know?
He changed his agenda.
Changed his agenda, okay.
Their own lack of faith.
They may have been looking forward to some sort of in-group time with Jesus, alone with them.
An intrusion on their personal time?
I find all that an interpretation.
Okay.
I don't see from what's written there that anybody's opposing it, actually. I mean, they may have had some different ideas and started one direction, and he gave it some other direction, but I don't hear any resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what opposition is, you know, we can have our own agendas.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and Carol's saying he gave them this task to take care of the crowd, and they said,
we don't have enough money, and we don't have the resources. I mean, it seems to me that what they try to do is to shove it right away from them, not my responsibility.
Except the disciples came to him and said, gave him a solution.
Or they perceived the problem anyway.
Yeah.
I look at that as almost being sarcastic though on their part. Because they're in a lonely place far away from anything. And they're saying, you want to go to the store and buy some bread? It's not available.
We don't know. I mean, we only know what we see there. And there's many ways that, without being able to get in their minds, these are all possibilities that seem likely, perhaps, from the story as things that could cause. The lack of resources is the only one that's clearly defined there. This is an impossible task.
Someone in our group pointed out, too, that they felt it was important to recognize where the disciples had just come from. And they had just come from witnessing the beheading of So they were possibly in quite a traumatized and vulnerable place themselves.
more aware of the impossibilities than the possibilities at that moment too. Okay. Yeah, those are all.
But also have been genuine concern for Jesus. Mm-hmm. Don't weariness.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it could be also. So many possibilities, and we don't know. But, yeah, we have sort of the gamut here of the best and the worst of them. You know, they could have been really concerned about Jesus, or they could have just, you know, not cared about people and just themselves. But we don't know, so we don't want to dwell on that, what we don't know. But lift those up as possibilities for later we can look at. Who benefited from this?
Everybody.
Anybody have anything besides everybody?
The 5,000 men and their families.
Okay, and
disciples.
Okay, so everybody benefited. That was.
In a political sense, Jesus benefited.
Okay. Made contact with a lot of people that day.
Word was spread.
So yeah, okay, you're saying that everybody present and others who heard about it, perhaps you're saying would benefit. Somebody says,
well, yeah, I guess so. For us.
Yeah. I think I'll just leave everybody. Interpret that as we will. Okay, now this is the part, you said this part was harder. What are we doing, if we are doing some of the things Jesus did, or what would we do if we were to really do what Jesus did here? To explore, who benefits by what we do?
We do, and the giver.
Okay, yeah, I think we'd probably say everybody. Did you notice that some of these actions, you could look at these actions in different kinds of ways. Do you see any categories in here? Some are named already, I think. The kinds of actions we do. For instance, it's charitable work. And it's kind of that direct action of helping other people. It's the kind that makes us feel the best for some reason a lot of times. Because we have that direct personal contact. But it doesn't always go quite as far as it did for Jesus. We also have areas of advocacy, you mentioned. Has anybody here participated in Bread for the World? That's an organized Christian movement around advocacy on hunger issues. It's a way of trying to make that even a stronger, more integrated impact. Lifestyle consumption. How many of you have actually, in your family or in your community, in your congregation, dealt with lifestyle around food, about consumption? Obviously, Holden has made an impact. What we consume and how. And then there's another one that I think we haven't really touched on yet. And for the sake of time, I think I'll mention as I look at this, one of the things that really stood out to me, I looked at this a long time and I said, there's really one basic thing that Jesus did that was real critical to the success of this event. And that is that Jesus took all the food that was available and turned around and gave it back to all the people. Yeah. Which is a very simple action. But when you think of it, it's more than charity, and it's more than advocacy, and it's more than it's connected to lifestyle. But that is a very fundamental action in that I don't think we've ever dared to try to even deal with. What does it mean to take all the available food to make sure that everybody has enough? And to trust in that process, there'll still be something left over. You know, I think as we look at what Jesus actually did, it was a very simple act, and yet the implications for us, I think, are probably more than we can normally handle in terms of thinking about that. And I think of the text from Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof and all those who dwell therein. And I think if the earth is one home for all of God's people, so that everybody has a home and everybody has food, and that how people are distributed unequally and the resources are distributed unequally. So what does that mean? Where all the people have food and have enough left over. That's sort of the thing that really, I haven't quite, you know, it rattles around in my mind too, as our goal perhaps is that, as we go about a variety of ways of coming at this issue, you know, how is it that we actually achieve that? And not fall into using what really belongs to people as something to control them. And the other thing that came to my mind, too, is the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. And the word that sticks out in there is our. give us this day our daily bread. You know, not mine and somebody else's and somebody else's, but just mine. And if you think that everybody is saying that, that there is a sense of which there is, it sort of focuses on that there is enough for everybody. Everybody has their own that should come to them. And instead of the fear of loss, there's a theology of fear of loss, I think, that governs our actions, or a wrong teaching. The teaching's important too, the blaming the victims. They're hungry, they must not have done something right. They must deserve to be hungry, they must not work hard. They must be criminals and therefore deserve to be hungry. Whatever it is that stops us from really looking at the whole, the world is one world rather than different compartments, each with their own little hordes of things. It's going to be very, very important. Anyway, like I said, this method is, if you do this a few times, it gets a little easier to focus. You can get right to the core pretty quickly. The hunger issue is one that we all want to resolve, I think we would all claim want to resolve. There are other Bible passages that are very interesting to do this with. If you just think of a couple, like, one obvious one is Jesus in the temple. That's a passage that has lots of action in it. I mean, you can, that's hard for church people to deal with, you know, because we have to realize that we're the temple. Yeah, that's. And another text that was very interesting we did once was on the woman caught in adultery that they were going to stone, and they took her to Jesus. And what's wonderful about that is that Jesus writes in the ground, but you never know what he says, so you can't focus on his words anyway. But dealing with the issue of sin, you know, people that we label as sinners, you know, what did Jesus do in that? There are a lot of ways you can really find your own limitations as to how far you're willing to go, and maybe what your growing edge is, for your faith to go a little deeper. And I think that for people in Latin America, this has led them into a very active form of response to the gospel. Yeah, everybody should have food. You know, I work this land every day just so some people can feast and the rest can starve. That doesn't make sense. And so new ways of being have come about. Mm-hmm.
We're looking at this kind of from a rosy standpoint.
I know.
If you look at it from, say, Yoder's standpoint in the politics of Jesus, or really from the our government standpoint, or even the individual power, food means power.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that has food has power. Jesus needed power to give, along with his mission. Mm-hmm. And you say everybody benefits. We didn't teach them how to raise the food or anything, so mm-hmm. they benefit for one day to start the next. And it's kind of that way. I mean, there are many ways we could look at this.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there really are. And that's why you could do this for a long time. I mean, it's sort of, you get the obvious answer right off. And then if you look a little deeper, well, there's something else down there. No, there's still something more in there. And to explore some of these things. One example I'll just leave you with too is that I visited a cooperative in Nicaragua, and I was asking this man who had formerly owned his own land, and he was now working in this cooperative. I asked him, well, you know, what's it like being on a cooperative as opposed to owning your own land? And is it better? And I sort of thought he'd say, well, yes, it's better. But he looked at me like I was from another planet and said, well, of course it's better. And he pointed out this old man that was sort of barely walking across the field, and he says, now look at that man. He has no children to farm his land for him. He obviously can't farm himself, but within the cooperative there are some things he can do, and this way he has a house and he has food. And he says, of course it's better. And I thought, well, that's, you know, the answer I expected, but as he said that, I realized again it was with different eyes. He was judging whether it was better or not on the basis of how good it was for the poorest and the most disadvantaged in that group. Whereas most of us, the supporters of the status quo, you know, we look at, yeah, this system's pretty good because I'm okay, you know. And if some people else aren't okay, then maybe we need to tinker with it a little bit so they're a little more okay. But to go right over there and say, well, if for this person it's okay, it must be great, you know. And that was a real lesson. I mean, I felt a little ashamed. I thought that must mean that deep in me I still have a lot of that you know, judging on the basis of my own well-being. But again, the well-being of the 5,000 and the well-being of other people is, I think, another way of focusing our sight on that, and will radically change how we deal with issues.